they could get in through that steam pipe, come out the other end. And Joyce Mitchell was supposed to be at that manhole cover at midnight on June 6th, and she never showed up.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus, and on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, it's been 10 years since the prison break in Northern New York. We're marking 10 years since a story that gripped Northern New York and the nation, the prison break from Dannemora and 23-day manhunt that followed.
It can be tough just looking for, let's say, a lost hiker and trying to look for two individuals who do not want to be found. It was very difficult.
Where did they go?
And in the initial stages, honestly, it's like chasing a ghost.
One minute we think they're still here in Dannemora, the next minute we think they're in Willsboro.
Spectrum News is among the outlets revisiting that dangerous month with a new special, Dannemora Retold a Decade Later, which airs June 10th. Joining me now to look back is Spectrum reporter Brian Dwyer. Brian, thank you for being with us.
Oh, absolutely.
I'll tell you my story, but you go first. How did you first hear about the prison break?
I was at home. I was sitting on my couch coincidentally watching our newscast, which is recorded at times. And so we were kind of going through a break period of where news had kind of been repetitive in the morning. And I got a call from the anchor, who coincidentally enough was the one that was actually on the air. And she goes, "Hey, I'm hearing something about a prison break way up north. And I think maybe we should prepare to send somebody up there." And I was the closest person there. I live up near Watertown. And in essence, I didn't really think it would be anything. Like, I kind of, in my mind, was like, oh, prison break. I mean, sure, they'll find the guys 10 minutes later. It'll be a waste of a three-hour trip up north to Malone in the Dannemora area. About an hour later, we heard Cuomo was on his way. Andrew Cuomo, the governor, then was on his way there and that sort of thing. And all this stuff was happening on June 6th. And my boss's boss called me and said, "Get going. Like, don't pack, don't do anything, just get in the car and go." I literally bought clothes and things to stay with when I got there. It was so strange. I was home, but I didn't want to even want to take the 15 minutes to pack. We just went.
I was here in the Albany newsroom, and we happened to be all at the station that day because we were doing some fundraising, which is always scheduled for June. So when the news came out, I started calling the New York State Police, public information person for the North Country. And most of those phone calls when you talk to state police are pretty pro forma. They're very measured. And I will never forget the chaos in the background I could hear when we called. They were busy. They did not have time to chat. They said, "We're trying to find the guys," and hung up. And that's when I knew, okay, this is going to be a huge story. And same kind of thing, you know, we scrambled our North Country reporter, Pat Bradley, almost immediately. So, you know, you and I remember it well, but for people who maybe don't know all the twists and turns, can you briefly tell us exactly what had happened?
Oh, that story could take a while.
Yeah.
So basically what happened is Richard Matt and David Sweat were working in the prison tailor shop. And they had gotten kind of acquainted with a woman named Joyce Mitchell, who was a supervisor in tailor shop number one at the time, the specific shop they worked in. Over time, they became friendly. As I said, there's questions on how friendly that was. But it got to a point where they felt comfortable giving her paintings and certain things that they were doing inside those prison cells during their time. They were very good artists, by the way, both of them were, especially Richard Matt. And so they would give her paintings and these sort of things. And eventually it turned into them going, "Could we ask her for stuff? Could we get stuff from her?" And that turned into kind of a plan. It kind of started to kick off, I believe David Sweat had mentioned it kicked off sometime in January of 2015 when they really thought about how they could do this. And they were getting tools, basically. They were getting drill bits. They were getting hacksaw blades. They were getting, you know, all sorts of different things that they could use. And they started in January taking that stuff that Joyce Mitchell would bring in through kind of cutting a hole in their cell block, which led to a catwalk, which led to walking downstairs and this, what we probably know as a 17-inch steam pipe that they had to crawl through. To get to a brick wall, they removed bricks. And I say they, and I really mean David Sweat, who did the majority of the work here. And then they eventually found their way to what was the manhole cover on Bauk and Barker Street, the corners of Bauk and Barker in Dannemora. And they realized they could get out that way. They spent about, I want to say, a good 5 months kind of rehearsing, doing all that work, getting all that stuff ready. One key thing was that steam pipe during the winter was used. It was really, really hot. They couldn't activate it. But once the heat started to come up a little bit in that area, they turned that pipe off, and that's when things really got put into motion. They realized they could get in through that steam pipe, come out the other end, and Joyce Mitchell was supposed to be at that manhole cover at midnight on June 6th, and she never showed up. So that's when the guys realized, we got to do this on foot. They actually did a trial run on June 5th, and David Sweat came out of that manhole cover on June 5th, put it back on, went back, and then stayed an extra night, and they did it all over again.
And we should just say, these guys were very dangerous. They had been convicted of violent crimes. So they had a level of, you know, ingenuity and street smarts in this plan. But as you say, the plan almost instantly went awry when the ride wasn't there. So what did they do at that point?
Well, according to David Sweat himself, who in this special, we had a chance to talk to a former New York State police investigator named Ted Leveson. And Leveson is the one that while you saw on Escape at Dannemora, the Ben Stiller documentary series, the little series they did there on Showtime, you saw Catherine Leahy Scott doing a lot of those interviews, the inspector general at the time. But the truth is, the first 3 days, the first person to interview David Sweat was Ted Leveson. And Ted talked a little bit about kind of not only their history, but he was able to get him to talk pretty much about everything that they did. And part of it was when they realized that Joyce wasn't going to show up, they walked down the street a little bit down. I believe it's Bauk Street. They walked down Bauk Street a little bit and came back to the site to actually see if she just was late or something. And she never showed up. And it just so happened, there's a white house on the corner of Bauk and Barker. And someone came outside at that exact moment and saw them. And it was like, hey, what are you doing in my backyard? And they were like, oh, no, you know, we're not doing anything. We're just taking a walk. So they came really close to actually being caught 2 minutes after they got out of that manhole cover. It just so happened that they were gone before anyone could respond to that call of someone had saw them. So they were almost immediately caught. But then they realized from there, they really had to be careful. And they were extremely careful. And David Sweat from Ted Leveson told me had a kind of an infatuation with the Marine life, that kind of military style life. And he really was smart, did a lot of reading while he was in prison, and understood things like, you know, where the sun position was to where they were, how mountains were able to work in terms of where you could search in mountains, where you couldn't search in mountains. So he was able to take a lot of that knowledge that he had read about in prison and use that as they were making their way on foot throughout the North Country.
Now, as a reporter at the time, this was it was one of the first big, you know, social media stories where rumors were getting posted and people were tweeting updates. And this is a vast section of the North Country. And no one really knew where they were. So there were a lot of leads to chase down. What were those 3 weeks like for you trying to, you know, snatch onto any piece of information you could?
Well, and that was kind of interesting because I want to say 3 or 4 days, I want to say June 9th. It was June 9th, 3 days after we'd realized they were gone. You know, we had all this big presence in Dannemora. You know, the police, CBP, they were everywhere. All sorts of different agencies were everywhere. And they were the big hitters. They weren't people that, you know, you would just send to a random. These guys were the guys that you don't mess with that were all kind of in Dannemora at the time. And I want to say 3 days they got this. They got a lead. And I was told, I just drove straight in what was known as Willsboro. The area of Willsboro, New York. And we went up there. A farmer had called in a tip that they had. Someone was kind of going through their stuff or that sort of thing. And he got there and saw police. And he got back to the farm and saw police everywhere. And we thought kind of that may be it. We saw them, that sort of thing. So we started getting online presence. You mentioned, you know, Twitter at the time. We did the video. We would send video. That's how we got video transmitted back sometimes, is we would take video on that, post it to our social media, and they could take it. Our station could take it from social media at the time and then post it on the air, whether it was just, you know, B-roll video of what was happening or us actually talking and describing what's happening. And then they would put that on TV from basically our social media pages. And I did a report that they were surrounding this farm in Willsboro. And it was one of those things that we kind of, you know, really played up in terms of, this is the big break that, that police needed. They're surrounding. And it turned out it was nothing, right? It was absolutely nothing. And it happened constantly, not only to us as media, and we can get into that story of how media kind of was aware of what was going on, it seemed, every time, every step of the way as well. But it seemed like it was happening to police as well. Ray Brook's major now, the state police major in Ray Brook, his name is Brett Davidson. And the Major Davidson talked about having some 2,800 leads, so 2,800 leads, calls that came in. And up until June 26th, day 21 of this search, not a single thing really turned up much of anything. And you can imagine that how frustrating that was for police. And it was frustrating for us as well because, hey, you know, we had been up there 3 weeks at that point doing social media, trying to get all these things, leading people into these thoughts, and it was going nowhere. And it was frustrating for everyone. And police, you know, admitted it's difficult to deal with not knowing and trying to learn things and trying to put things out there. And we were trying to get as much from them as possible. And it just turned out that at points they probably gave away too much information to us back then. I'm not going to argue that point. We were doing our jobs reporting what they told us, but maybe they probably told us a little bit too much. And I think that's one of the lessons they've learned. Because we were putting things out there that was wrong, probably, that was incorrect, or at least not wrong, but when they would find out later was an incomplete fact or an incomplete thing. It was too early to be putting the information out that was being put out. And, you know, that was part of the problem. That was part of the process. And it was 3 weeks of that before there was really any relief.
And so eventually they were caught. They were nabbed. And it brought an end to the manhunt. So how did authorities finally find them?
So interesting fact there. So obviously, starting June 9th, June 10th, that date, a couple of days later, they had been interviewing the prison tailor supervisor, Joyce Mitchell, for quite some time. They had gotten a lot of information from her, different information. Ted Leveson described it as, and Major Davidson described it as a person who was just trying to save themselves, would tell different stories. But as long as they kept her talking, even if they were lies, they could figure out what she was doing, piece it together, and figure out the truth from there. And she was telling a lot of lies, according to police, but they were able to piece it together. And what happened was they came upon the break on June 26th. It was a situation where a family from Brushton had a couple of trailers, a couple of camper trailers. They were driving up Route 30 in Malone, and a gunshot fire was heard. They pulled over, checked out their camper, and saw a bullet hole in one of their campers. Kept driving, obviously, because they were terrified of what had happened, and pulled over somewhere safe, called police, and immediately police rushed that area to the point where the Customs and Border Protection's BORTAC team, which is a group of serious individuals, flew in on helicopter, landed their helicopter on the middle of State Route 30, and the police presence was massive. And there's a white camper with some blue trim there that Richard Matt had been staying in for the past couple of days. And that was immediately after David Sweat had left him. They separated. David Sweat realized he's gone as far as he could go with Richard Matt. Richard Matt was sick. Richard Matt was drinking a lot in these cabins that they would break into. So that tip call came in, and everyone realized there was something different about this tip call than the previous 2,800 that they had received. The BORTAC team entered the field by this trailer, by this camper, and Richard Matt coughed. That was it. He coughed. The BORTAC team pushed forward. A man that we interviewed for our special, his name is Chris Voss, a member of that BORTAC team, pushed forward upon hearing that cough and came face to face with a man lying on the ground and noticed a shotgun was being lifted from underneath him and pointed directly at him. He took fire, and Richard Matt was killed in that process. Did not know it was Richard Matt at the time. They recognized a tattoo on his body and were able to confirm that it was Richard Matt. And at the time, they thought that maybe Richard Matt had killed David Sweat somewhere in the area, so they were still going to search. But they knew at that point that David Sweat was still in the area as well. And they finally saw some light at the end of the tunnel.
You know, this whole situation, and we have 10 years of distance now, raised a lot of questions about the culture inside the prison. How could something like this happen? What reforms need to be made? And obviously, it's not the same story, but there's been a lot of attention on New York prisons this year, given the wildcat strikes and so on and so forth. So with some distance, were there any notable changes within Dannemora and other prisons in New York that came as a result of this, you know, highly unprecedented 23 days?
So, yeah. So after 2 days later on June 28th, when Jay Cook, the New York State trooper, was on the Coveytown Road and pulled across and saw a man running in the field, and that was David Sweat. And he was able to shoot and capture David Sweat. And that's a part of our special that's, you have to see it. It's fantastic. Jay Cook did his very first TV interview with us for this 10 years later, had never done TV, and described his day, his demeanor, his everything about that event. And it's pretty special. But when that happened, it did not take long for major changes to be made. I mean, obviously there were personnel changes made at the prison. There's an interesting story that is unfortunate, that the person who replaced Joyce Mitchell also found herself in trouble with the law for relationships with inmates as well. So it was still a struggle to find people on the inside that could do the job and do it properly and do it well. But they made a number of changes. They paved over and made that manhole cover a permanent part of the road. They did a lot of things inside of that prison, but there's not really, they did a lot of things to make it more secure, right? To make it more unable to be broken out of. And I think there was a lot of things that put in place across the state that kind of did that same thing of, hey, are we doing the checks? Are we doing what we need to do? Are we secure with what we need to do? But of course, as time goes and everyone knows, things kind of tend to ease up a little bit. And what never really got addressed, according to some of the folks, was, just how prison guards are treated inside of prisons, how much responsibility they have, how much work they do. And while there's certainly no excuse for what Joyce Mitchell did, for what Gene Palmer did in being the person that brought in some of those tools unknowingly, according to him.
And he was one of the, sorry to interrupt, but he was one of the slightly compromised guards in all this relationship.
Correct. Gene Palmer was the guy who Joyce Mitchell had convinced to bring in frozen hamburger meat. And inside of that meat was drill bits and hacksaw blades and that sort of thing. And he didn't know, according to him and according to people that we've talked with state police and Clinton County District Attorney Andrew Wiley, don't believe he really knew what he was doing. He knew he was doing something he shouldn't be doing, bringing things in, but didn't realize that he was helping to the scale of what he did. And I think there's a lot of people that don't kind of realize that it's an environment where if you're not, and this is coming from some COs in the past couple of months here, if you're not friendly, if you're not able to get a relationship with these guys, that your life's in jeopardy. There's not anything inside some of these prisons that stops these guys in common areas from attacking. And when it's 60 on one, when there's drugs involved that are getting into the system, it becomes a very difficult place to work for a lot of these COs, and they'd had enough. And that stems back. That's nothing new in the New York State prison system, that COs are worried about their lives. They're worried about drugs coming in. They're worried about the violence. And we've seen over the past couple of months some of the videos and some of those things, and it's real. And so there's a balance between how do you become friendly with these guys to ensure your safety inside of this, but also not become a situation like what happened 10 years ago.
You mentioned the Ben Stiller Showtime series, and there's obviously been some other like TV movie adaptations of it. Is your memory of that whole month different from how it's been portrayed in pop culture since then?
I mean, there was a Lifetime movie that I think that came out like maybe a year, and that was just, I mean, I don't know what that was. That was not a great representation of what happened. The cool thing about what Ben Stiller's team did is he went and he talked. He not only talked, but I mean, he met with Jay Cook. Jay Cook walked him through the entire process of what it was like that day that he was able to capture David Sweat and end this whole thing. He spoke with all of the police majors. He got all of the information. He went through and got all the photographs that were taken almost immediately after maybe immediately a month later to try to figure all this stuff out. And all of that photographs, and I've seen these photographs because we actually requested them for our special, and they'll be part of our special as well. You notice things like when Richard Matt is dreaming of breaking out of prison, there's a shot in the episode, and I want to think it's the pilot episode one, where he looks out and you just see this big steam tower in the distance behind the prison that kind of represented him getting outside and being free. That's a direct photo from the Inspector General reports. So they did an amazing job, I thought, of not only getting access to Dannemora. They actually shot a lot of that in Dannemora. They had a couple of days where they could use empty parts of the prison, the outside of the prison, and shot a lot of that. And then other people kind of went around and drew pictures and drew different things on paper that allowed them to recreate a lot of the inside the prison scenes in Los Angeles. But they did a fantastic job of really taking what the Inspector General gave them and turning that into very realistic stuff. And as I went through and watched it again the second time this year, we went through when we were driving to Dannemora, and I was kind of in the passenger seat as our photographer was driving, and I was watching some of these old episodes and going, I know exactly what happens here because it was directly laid out in the Inspector General report. It was directly laid out. And so they really followed that to a T, and I thought that was really well done. There was one part that I think state police weren't all that thrilled with, and that was kind of how they portrayed the aspect of the physical relationships that maybe were still up in the air between Richard Matt and David Sweat and Joyce Mitchell as well. And there were some that thought that was a little over the top, and maybe that was, maybe that wasn't. I don't really know those details. But just the break itself, the prison escape itself, seeing people drive up on four-wheelers and them running out of the building, it was all to a T. It was all really well done and really well researched.
Well, congratulations, Brian, on the special Dannemora Retold a decade later on Spectrum News. And our guest, Brian Dwyer, covered the prison break 10 years ago for Spectrum. We really appreciate your time and your memories. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.